Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
We talk about God in our life.
Yeah. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher. This episode, we talk to half of rap's greatest duo ever, Gene No Malice Thornton of The Clips. The artist formerly known as Malice and his brother Terrence, aka Pusha T, first broke on the scene with the massive 2002 hit Grindin'. The brothers Thornton went on to release three albums and several mixtapes worth of influential rap. They had some help along the way from a production duo who were their Virginia neighbors, Pharrell Williams and Chad Hugo, better known as the Neptunes. In April 2009, shortly before the release of the duo's Till the Casket Drops album, their former manager Anthony Jeezy Gonzalez and several of their close friends were arrested for running a drug ring, something we talk about towards the end of this interview. Shortly after that, Malice embraced the religiosity that had always been present in his rhymes and changed his name to No Malice. He replaced his old cocaine-fueled rhymes with more righteous lyrics and released his solo debut, Hear Ye Him, in August 2013. We talked to No Malice via Skype from his home in Virginia. We are here with No Malice, rapper, memoirist, podcast host. And one half of the greatest duo ever, The Clips.
Wow, I'll take that. I will definitely take that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's going to start at the beginning. Like, you were born in the Bronx. You lived there until you were maybe 7 or 8.
Right. Had just turned 8.
Okay. And what were your early memories of hip-hop? Because that was right around the time, you know, maybe 73 was, you know, Herc's first party or whatever. What were your early memories of hip-hop?
Well, you know, my earliest memories of hip-hop would definitely be my older brother. You know, when we lived in the Bronx, I just remember looking off of my terrace and looking at my brother and his friends down there breakdancing on cardboard with the boom box out there and just breakdancing. I'm talking about sheepskins, Kangos, Gazelles, like the earliest days, you know what I'm saying? When everything was just first starting.
Yeah. And do you remember any music from that era?
Oh, definitely. Like I remember the Sugar Hill Gang, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, we have an older brother and sister. So they were like up on everything, you know, when it first happened. So I definitely have memories of Sugar Hill Gang and memories of Kraftwerk.
Amazing.
Trans Europe Express. You familiar with that?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, man. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
You know what's up.
Trans Europe Express. Trans Europe Express. Trans.
And, but it seemed like the rappers who really got to you.
Yeah.
At least as far as like ones you've mentioned on records and have talked about being influential are
right.
Like, you know, after maybe, you know, 7 or so years after that from like,
right.
You know,
kind
of late 80s.
Absolutely. Like, I just took it all the way back for you. You said my earliest.
Yeah.
So I did that. But, you know, the guys that meant everything to me were cats like definitely Run DMC. I absolutely loved Run DMC. Big Daddy Kane, Rakim, Cool G Rap, the whole Juice Crew, man.
I was going to say that the Juice Crew are people you mentioned probably more than any other artist, just as far as like name dropping in your rhymes.
Yeah, man. Because it has always been a lyrical game. Like to me, rap don't even matter unless it's lyrical. You know what I'm saying? And that has always been my stance on it. And, you know, just those words and to be slick with those words and to make your point, but in a very creative way. To me, that's hip hop.
Yeah, and I noticed, like, you know, the very first song on Lord Willin, right? The intro, and it's like your introduction to the world. I know you'd record an album before, but like,
right.
You know, your very first album that you knew was coming out, your very first verse, you quote Paid in Full.
So I start my mission, leave my residence. Mama knew that a child like me had better sense.
So that just got me thinking, like,
right.
What do you think you learned, like, specifically from Rakim?
Well, you know, what I learned from Rakim was, and you have to remember, like, I was a huge Run DMC fan, so I thought it was, like, I just love how Run just came so strong, and he, you know, he was, like, always yelling, you know what I'm saying? So to me, I was just a big fan of that, but when Rakim came, it was just, like, calm and chill, and I can still get it off, you know what I'm saying, by you know, just chilling and being laid back. So it was just a different style.
Yeah, definitely. That makes me think about the exclusive audio footage record, which, you know, was never released but is bootlegged pretty heavily. About when were you guys recording that? When were you writing and recording that?
Exclusive audio footage, that was around, late 90s, man.
Mm-hmm.
It was the late 90s.
Wow. So it seemed like, listening to it now, like, you know, you're pretty recognizable. You know, your brother's using a different name and he sounds a little different, but it's still him. But it didn't seem like you'd quite found, like, the distinctive clips thing yet. And then, but by Lord Willin, it was fully there. And I was just curious if you could talk about, like, that process of, like, or if you even thought about it that way, finding, like, what made clips distinctive.
Nah, you know, it was never about finding what made us distinctive. It's pretty much about just being who we were, who we are, you know. And in my case, again, who I was. But, everything just, as you grow, you know, people just tune in to different facets. Like, exclusive audio footage was, you know, just rap. And even Lord Willin to me was just rap. Hell Have No Fury, just rap. You know what I'm saying? And just talk about your life and where you are. It was never a thing of, I'm going to try to come off like this or try to come off like that. Like, what you see is truly what you got.
I mean, it's funny because you take it back to that record, you know, and the stuff you're doing now connects in a really strong way. You start that record off with a prayer.
I guess what I'm saying right now, Lord, is that if these words hurt more than they help, I could only hope that you would have mercy upon our souls. Amen.
Bro, let me tell you something, man. Like, let me tell you something. And people can miss it if they want to, but I know for certain that God was working on me then. If you listen to our catalog, if you listen to, you know, the music, and like you said, we even started it off with a prayer. And what a lot of people don't know is before every show, we've been on tour with 50, we've been on tour with Jay-Z, Black Eyed Peas, Nelly, you know, just we always prayed before our show. So this is really who I have been. Now, I haven't always, you know, conducted myself in that matter. I haven't always chased after the Lord, you know, but it's about also being human and who you are and making mistakes. But at the same time, you gotta learn from some of the mistakes. You know, nobody really should stay the same. Everyone should be growing. And like you just said, if you go back to the first album, Exclusive Audio Footage, you know, we started it with a prayer. We even have a whole song that basically sound like you're praying all the way through. And a lot of people, the fans, they tell me now via Twitter and Instagram and stuff like that, they'd say to me, you know, they could see that I was pretty much headed in this direction when I didn't even know it.
Right. And even on that record, you know, you have a whole sort of interlude about, like, oh, I hate going to the club, and yet I find myself at the club every night. Like, even then you're sort of wrestling with, you know, yeah, the material things and stuff, yeah, like that.
Yeah. You know, bro, and I'm glad you pointed that out, because I don't shake my finger at people for what they do. I mean, I have been I like to think I did it the best. The clubs, the girls, you know, the smoking. Like, I like to think that I truly did it the best. So I can't go around, you know, condemning or trying to tell somebody how to live. What I do is I just try to share my life experiences. And one of the things that I noticed, bro, was that when I would be in the club, I felt awkward. I didn't feel cool. I felt awkward. And I would have to drink in order to fit in. Now, once I started drinking, I was the star of the show, standing on tables, throwing money, doing, you know, doing all of that. But that should have been my first red flag that I had to get out of my right mind, out of my sober mind to fit in. So I knew something wasn't, you know, registering with me internally.
Yeah, it's funny you say that about feeling awkward. I've only met your brother once, but I had seen him perform the night before, and he was, you know, all in black, the majestic hand gestures, you know, just the essence of cool. And I met him the next day and I was like, oh, it's, you know, enthusiastic, you know, slightly in some ways awkward guy who's very excited about rap and talking about writing. Mm-hmm. So I recognize that same sort of, like, you know, on stage, it seems one way, but there is like a little bit of, you know, awkwardness in humanity, like when you meet him face to face.
Absolutely, bro. Absolutely. I know what you're talking about. As far as, you know, my brother, like, and myself, very much real people. Like, we get it. You know, we get it. And we always understood what was entertainment. We always understood, you know, what was reality. And we always said, you know, we always listened to cats like, you know, N.W.A. We listened to the raunchiest of the raunchiest, or the gangsterest of the gangsters. But we still kept it in its proper place. It never raised us. It never made us go out and do now, you know, do those things we were listening to. But not everyone has that luxury. For some, they live and die by what they hear, what I see. That's how I'm going to dress. That's how I'm going to talk. That's how I'm going to act. Now, you know, we were never like that. So, you know, it's a difference.
Yeah. But you had that experience as artists, right? Sometime, like, I think it probably happened in the hiatus between the first two records. You noticed people started dressing like you.
Oh, yeah. I definitely noticed that we were trendsetters, you know, and just being abreast of fashion and everything dope. And I get that. I mean, you know, I believe it's cool to emulate some things. I believe it's cool to find, you know, certain styles and stuff like that. I just don't think you should just, you know, live and die by what anyone does.
On a personal level, though, was that weird for you to look out and see, you know, see a kid's, you know, dressed in Bape and...
No, I don't think so. I mean, I get it. And even, you know, when we were put onto it, we had to be introduced to it ourselves, too. And we really dug it and it stood out. And I think everybody is looking for some kind of identity, you know, I mean, everyone. And especially if you don't know who you are, everybody's in search of. So, you know, if people want to kind of follow, you know, what we were doing, I think we were cool enough guys to follow.
Yeah. And I want to talk about specifically writing for a second, because I feel like that sometimes gets lost in, you know, your story and the talk about drugs and all this kind of stuff. Probably the main thing I really love about the writing in the clips is there's like a real exactness, like how you guys build a verse. You start with a line and it connects to the next idea, and you use an image and it comes back. Like, it's just really, really well connected, the images, the ideas, the phrases. Where did that come from?
Well, that comes from, it really comes from, bro, like I said before, really being who we are, like who we are. We are intellectuals. We truly are intellectuals, very articulate, very observant in everything. Like, I mean, bro, I see things happen before they even happen. Like, I am just very aware, and I've always been like that for as long as I can remember, you know. So I do believe it's a gift. And like you say, you take, as far as my writing goes, I always try to come from a place that I was, that I've been. A place that I've seen, heard, smelled, tasted. I start from there, you know, and I think that's why the people or the fans, especially the D-Boys who love Clips music, they recognize, they can say, oh, I know what he's thinking. Oh, I've been right there in that particular place. And I think that's, you know, why a lot of our fans really get it.
Yeah. And, One of the other things that makes you guys notable is, you know, you're a group, but you don't always present a united front. Like, you guys will disagree about things, right? You have different takes on things. Like, you've expressed very different opinions about the hiatus, and even on Shame the Devil, which is a song on the new record.
Right.
You know, you have two very different views about, you know, the subject matter you've been rapping about. So What about your group, about your relationship, allows you to make your disagreements public? I feel like I can't think of many other groups that would do that.
Well, I hate to sound redundant, but it's very much about being true to yourself. You know, we are brothers, but we are not one in the same. For the most part, we do agree on a lot of things, not everything, but, you know, we respect each other's different takes. Disagreements isn't the thing. It's how you handle them. And you know, Pusha is his own man. I'm my own man. And what I believe in, I believe in. Like, no one can budge me off nothing I believe in. And he's pretty much the same way.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And you know, one thing about the catalog is you listen to it and there's a ton of Miami Vice references. And I was just always curious about that. All the while, alluding Tubbs and Crockett out the game unscathed, never the
name on the docket. It's only logic. I'm only about a movie. Yeah. Oh, Miami Vice. I'm sitting here now looking at my Miami Vice, not a doll collection, but I'm looking at Crockett and Tubbs right now, like collector edition Miami Vice dolls. It was just that show back in the day. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, you know, get into a little bit about, you know, you wrote a memoir not that long ago.
Right, right.
And you're very open about your life in it. One of the things that I didn't know was that you had spent 2.5 years in the Army.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you did that, you kind of came back from the Army and saw that Terrence, your younger brother, and now Pusha T, had kind of taken your place dealing amongst the same crew you were hanging out with. How did you feel when you came back and saw that?
Well, the whole thing is, first, when I was in the Army, and this says a lot about self-determination, I guess. But when I was in the Army, you know, I had only signed up to go in there for 2 years. Like, I'm like, that's all I'm doing. And it was available to me. And Pharrell was like, yo, we need to go, you know, get these deals. So, you know, when you come out, let's go ahead and get these deals. You know what I'm saying? And that's exactly what happened. And when I would go home, you know, all of my homies would tell me, they'd be like, yo, your brother's out here, man, da 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 da, you know, and, you know, I'm looking out for him, you know, I'm watching him, but I'm just letting you know he's out here. And I was like, you know, it wasn't too much I could do because I was no longer there. You know what I'm saying? And he's growing up and he was pretty much in. I know it sounds crazy, but he was in good hands because, you know, I knew everybody and everybody knew that was my brother. And, you know, I guess it was the best of a bad situation, but it wasn't too much I could do about it. But I did have enough confidence that my brother was a thinker like myself. So I knew 100 dudes would get caught before he did.
Right. And you said something really interesting. And you also said this on record, which I hadn't realized listening back. And you talk about it in the book. That time in the Army, that like two and a half years where it was you and your wife and she had just had a child, and you guys had, you know, no money, and a, you know, I'd imagine a pretty small sort of army housing, that was really the happiest time in your life.
Absolutely. You can focus on the simple things before things got too busy. You know, a lot of times you don't know what you want. And I remember being out at some function in New York, some big gala, something. And LL told me, he said, careful what you wish for. I didn't quite get it, but I believe I get it now. You know what I'm saying? Careful what you wish for.
So, you know, you, by the time Lord Willin came out and, you know, you'd promoted Grindin' and, you know, I know it took probably almost a year for Grindin' to become a hit. By that time you were a little older than most rappers are when they break. And, you were probably about 30 or so when that really broke. And I guess I was just curious about how you related to other artists who were sort of in your class, like new artists who broke around 03, 04, since they were, you know, maybe 5 years, maybe even some of the younger ones, 10 years younger than you were at that point.
How did I relate to them? You know, I've always been, I guess, a little more mature than the regular. You know, I seen cats that they stay up all night and stay in the studio and live in the studio and, you know, and that's their life and that's their hustle, you know. And listen, I have nothing, you know, that's probably what makes a great artist. But as for me, you know what I'm saying? For me, it was rap. It came second nature. I enjoyed it. But I still wanted to move how I wanted to move. I didn't want to be confined to having to do anything, you know. And I think that was one of my issues when we were on the road, because we were on the road so much. And, you know, if it was a dollar anywhere, we had to go get it, you know. And you'll be on tour and you think you're about to go home and see your family and chill for a minute. And then all of a sudden, something pop up. You know, and then you have to run and get that dollar, you know, and it just seemed to me like a constant chasing of a dollar. And I think I have always been wise enough to know that although the money is good and we all do need money, I just didn't want to be like in bondage to that. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And definitely one of, you know, the second Clips album, you know, post hiatus, Hell Hath No Fury, is, you know, was when it came out, was incredibly well reviewed. And I was just curious if you'd read any of the reviews around it when it first came out.
I'm sure I did. I am sure that I read some of the reviews. I don't quite remember them, but I'm sure at the time, you know, just being nosy, seeing what people think of it. But I know at that time, it was very, Hell Hath No Fury for me was very, very heartfelt. It was a lot of different emotions going on at that time. It was anger. It was frustration. And so on that album, you know, I just kind of let everything loose, everything that was, you know, pent up.
Yeah. And it shows sometimes in unexpected ways. So Dirty Money is, you know, sounds like a celebratory song, but I hear a lot of sadness in there in some ways.
Hey, you ain't gotta love me, just be convincing. I don't ask much, some ashes on the cuff. And it's so
if, yeah, it's a lot, you know, I'm the king of melancholy. You know what I'm saying? I like to think that my music, my lyrics, are just real. And to go back and to revisit some of that and the people that you know, still enjoy our music and the fans, even at that time, I hope what they get from it is an honesty. You know, you can count on what I say. Like, I'm not just sitting there just trying to make up something, trying to make me look cool. Like, I'm talking to you where I'm at this particular point in time in my life. You know, and I hope that they get, you know, that honesty.
Yeah. On Mama, I'm So Sorry, you talk about your grandmother being mad at you for kind of saying a bunch of stuff about her on the first record.
I'm sorry, Grandmama, for mistakes I have made. When I aired Family Business, how you put me in my place. Even my baby.
Right, right.
Is that true? What was that actually like?
I know you didn't just ask Eclipse. Is that true? I have such fond memories of my grandmother, and you know, as a child I was exposed to a lot of different things, and you know, some things you think are cool, and some things, you know, you just, as a child, you just don't know any better. But my grandmother, you know, she spoke to me and she was like, you know, those things were back in the day. And she's like, I'm an old lady now, you know, and she didn't want to be like known for that kind of stuff. Like, you know, like life changes for people. You grow, you get older, you get wiser. And I understood her and I can't do nothing but respect that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And, you know, I know Wamp Wamp on that album had some of your most sort of infamous lyrics. And I was just curious what if any, you know, blowback you ever got on either the you know, on any of the lines on there.
You'd have to refresh my memory, brother.
Okay. There, like, was the deep like the Hutu line on that song.
In motion, the family close knit, and deep like the Hutu, you cockroaches.
I am very, let me tell you something. You know what? This is God right here. This is God right here. Because even to this day, that has been on my mind of how I was going to address it, because I am definitely going to address that line. Do you know, I've never gotten any feedback from that line except for one time and that was the time that it was brought to my attention. Now, when I wrote that line, I didn't even know one way or the other exactly what was taking place. Like I said, I was very observant and I caught like part of it on the movie. So it wasn't like I was aware of, you know, the ins and outs of that terrible, you know, plight on humanity at that time. I didn't know. I'm thinking in my mind that, you know, somebody's going to catch on, or if they know anything about current events, they'll see what I'm saying. But at that time, I didn't even know. But I say all of that to say this. I was 100% wrong in saying anything, the nerve and the audacity of me to say anything like that. You know, people lost their lives. People, you know, lost family members. It's even more horrific than I could even imagine. So what I said was out of pure ignorance, stupidity, and I apologize to everyone who took offense, and everyone should have taken offense to that, because I myself am offended by it and horrified that I would even could say such a thing, whether it was ignorance or not. I was dead wrong.
Wow. That's really intense. And I guess, like, some of the beats on that album I wanted to talk to you about for a minute, because they're like, they're the most kind of minimal version of the Neptunes, who are already pretty minimal by that point. But it's kind of like, almost like, how weird can you get and still be accessible? How minimal can you get and still be accessible? It was like, they and you both, I think, were trying for like the most refined version of what it is that you guys do.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the Neptunes really knew how to handcraft that music and cater it to tailor it to our styles. Like I said, to me, it's always been about the lyrics. It just so happens we have had the most incredible creative producers. So, you know, so we lucked up on that one. But for us, It's been always been a lyric thing. I want people to hear what I have to say and how I say it, and you know, and how I twist and turn it, and the double entendres and the you know, the metaphors and you know, the analogies and all of that. I really want people to get it. I didn't want to, you know, get lost into I didn't want to get lost behind, you know, so much music.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was so funny. I was reading an interview with where you were like, yeah, you know, we loved working with the Neptunes. And you said there was, when you were coming up, there was one other guy whose beats you rocked with.
Yeah.
And it was DJ Timmy Tim, who would later be Timberland.
DJ Timmy Tim. You know what? And it's so crazy because I was known for MCing like in school and on the street, this, that, and the third, but I would never take it serious because all of the music that I heard, it just never moved me. So a homie of mine told me, he was like, yo, I got this dude. I'm telling you, I know you don't like writing to nobody's music, but this dude got the music. I was like, all right. He introduced me to him. It was DJ Timmy Tim, Timbaland. Me and Timbaland was just, you know, always making music over his crib. And, you know, and even then, like, this is high school. So, you know, those guys was talented even then. You know, you could see something in them then.
Are there tapes of you and Malice and Timbaland in high school? Are there tapes?
I you know what? I don't think so. Unless Tim has them. But I don't have any. But I do have like some real early. I mean, stupid early, before exclusive audio footage, Neptunes, you know, throwbacks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. So your latest record, Hear Ye Him, you know, the first solo album.
Right.
There are a bunch of themes on that. A big one was this idea of coming to terms with your own past, you know, both artistically and, you know, whatever you may have done in your life.
Right.
And so I was curious about this idea of like writing about your own faults, writing about your regrets in rap, which is a genre where most of the time you want to appear invulnerable and the coolest guy in the room.
Right. You know, I've had that stage too. You know, I've been there. And with me, I can only write where I am currently. I like to think that the people that grew up with me grew up with me. You know, and I can't, you know, continue to appease a younger generation if I am not, you know, at that point anymore. You know what I'm saying? I have to sleep with myself, so I got to look at myself in the mirror, and I also have to appease myself as well intellectually. So I'm, you know, I understand, you know, you young and you coming up, and there's a new kind of fervor, there is a new energy, and you know, and kids, some of them, you know, they're rebellious and they want to hear this and they want to do that kind of thing, and I get it. For me to act like I don't get it, you know, I'd be lying, but I get it. I've been there. All I'm saying is I'm not there now, and I can't keep repeating the third grade for whoever comes up after me. You know what I'm saying? And so be it. So be it. If, you know, if the budgets are different now and things aren't as the same, you know, I can understand that. And I get it. I definitely get it. You know, and I have kids. I have kids. And it's more important to me that I have their respect than anything else.
Yeah. And so on the new album, you have that line where you say, malicious is something I should have never been.
But clearly malicious is something I should have never been. Here's to the death of him. We gonna say your prayer.
Do you feel like you regret your time as Malice?
No. Actually, it has definitely made me, you know, who I am today. So I don't regret it. You know, I've made a lot of bad choices, and we all do. And I don't think it's about making bad choices. I think it's a shame and sad if you never realize it and you never come out of it. You know, I mean, believe it or not, I mean, I got cats around me here at home that are my age and they still trying to become a rapper. You know what I'm saying? And I ain't no dream killer, but at some point, man, like for real, like you just got to be real.
Yeah. And another big thing on the record is, you know, criticizing rappers today specifically for kind of glorifying street life, glorifying drugs, the kind of stuff you're talking about. You have that particular line about trap music. You say, you know, blinded is him who calls it a trap yet still enters in. What would you tell today's like trap artists?
Hold on a second. I didn't criticize anybody.
Okay.
I'm big on not criticizing everything that's going on today. I've done it. I wouldn't dare call the kettle black. Matter of fact, that's one of the lines on my album. For blinded is him who calls it a trap, yet still enters in.
Yeah.
I just thought it was ironic that we call it a trap. We label it a trap and we still go in it. It doesn't change your mind from doing it. And I'm just wondering, what does it take to change your mind? Like, you already know what it is.
Yeah.
I wanted to point that out because, like I said, you know, I've been guilty. And I look at the bigger picture, bro, and I don't expect anyone or everyone to have the heart I have. What I do, I have a very special story. I have a very special scenario. The equation of my life is very unique, and I'm not trying to say you should be like me. No, I'm not saying that at all. All I'm doing is taking the story that God has given me, and I'm sharing it. I'm not the babysitter. I'm not the teacher. I'm not the Lord. I'm just sharing my story. If you thought anything about Malice was cool, if you thought anything was intriguing or interesting about Malice, if you believed Malice in any kind of way, if you found him to be credible, you know, I would do you a disservice if I didn't tell you the entire story or just dropped it off where I wanted to. I don't have nothing to gain, you know, from telling my shortcomings. I ain't, you know, it's obviously ain't about money. So, you know, I'm just keeping it real.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of biblical references on the new record. But I mean, one of the things about that, like I was saying, is that you've always done that.
Always.
Yeah.
From day one.
Yeah.
You said it, not me.
So one of the greatest things, you know, going in the Clips days was using biblical metaphors when talking about coke. On the price, I don't budge to double up on birds like Noah in the flood. And talking about street.
Right.
And it was just such an effective thing. And I was just curious, like, A, sort of why you thought that particular device was so effective. And also, like, when you first started doing that.
There is something about the truth, right? It is something about the word of God that everybody, they want to fasten themselves to the truth, but then put their own spin on it. It is something about that word of God that is just so, is so true, but then you have to add yours to it, you know, and then just go ahead and ruin it. It does not become a problem until you start really trying to abide by what you know to be true. You know, you can say God joking around, but the second you say God and mean it, whoa, oh, it's a problem now. So I get that, and I see that, and I'm learning. You know, I've learned, you know, from over the course of time, you can say a lot of things in jest, and it's something about it's something about a lie that always wants to ride on the coattails of the truth. You know, a lie just don't stand alone. Like, you, it's not even cool if it stand alone, like it's boring. But you tack on a lie to some truth, man, you got you a concoction there. And that was that had a lot to do with a lot of my lyrics.
Yeah, definitely. And you kept that going. And in fact, by the time Till the Casket Drop came out, that had even, you know, far more biblical references than,
bro,
the previous albums.
It's real. It's really real. And, you know, there is even a verse in the Bible, and I'm paraphrasing it, and shame on me for not having it, knowing it by heart. But it's God basically saying, oh, you have used my name so much You have said my name so much. Now I'm going to show you what it means to reference me. And I feel like that's my life. I felt like I used his name so much, you know, and he's going to really like make me walk it now. You know what I'm saying? And it's just what it is, but it's a good walk. It's a better walk. And I absolutely love it. And I have so much peace.
That's amazing. I mean, I think there's definitely stuff on the new album where you talk about, you know, coming to peace with your relationship with Pharrell, with, you know, your past relationships with women, with your brother, that just shows that you really are at peace with a lot of stuff that was contentious for a while.
Well, yeah, you know, the thing is, honestly, it's about loving people. It's about loving people, period. Yeah, someone may have trespassed against you and done something wrong to you, but you've done the same thing too. And when you start realizing who we are as people and that we are all broken in some kind of way, whether if people were to just take a self-evaluation of their own self, you don't have to listen to a preacher. You don't have to listen to a guru. You don't have to listen to nobody. If you take inventory of your own life and look inside yourself, you will find that you are broken. And once we understand that about humanity, you know, that you can be forgiving. You know, whatever you've done to me, I've done to somebody else, and I ain't always been right. You know what I'm saying? I haven't always been perfect, and we are not perfect. So once we understand that, we can really be more forgiving toward one another. Yeah. And that's just real with me.
Definitely. And I wanted to ask specifically we're talking about the Casket Drops record a minute ago. Was any of that, we don't have to, you know, I certainly am not going to ask about details or anything, but was any of that written or recorded after Anthony's arrest?
For the most part, it was done. Mm-hmm. If there's something specifically
about. Nothing specific. It's just I find that interesting because I feel almost like I almost heard just in terms of mood and tone, especially on your verse, it almost seemed like it happened afterwards, like it was recorded afterwards.
Nah, because I even shot some blogs and with Tony in them. And we was talking about, you know, the record's about to drop. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And matter of fact, that record, that Till the Casket Drops came out, I believe, in April.
Okay, so right around the same time.
Yeah, and they got locked in April. They got locked April 9th. It's funny because I was in Miami, and Tony kept telling me, he showed up in Miami, and I was like, yo, what are you doing here? Like, you know, what we working, what's going on? And he was like, nah, I just wanted to come out here and chill with y'all, da, da, da. And I kind of felt like something was wrong. Like, I don't know what it was. But then my man Rat, he also came out with Tony. And I told Rat, I don't know what made me say this, but we were in the studio with Pharrell. I'm sitting down with Rat. And I said, Rat, I said, if you go to jail, it would break my heart. So then we came home like at 6 a.m, caught a flight at 6 a.m. Tony and Rat were to come home later. When they got ready to get to the airport, they got a call from the accountant saying that all the money was froze up. And if y'all go to the airport, you know, they're going to be at the airport waiting on you. You know what I'm saying? So by the time I got home, Pusha called me and asked me, did I hear about what happened? And I was like, I said, no, what happened? And everybody was getting locked up. Like all of our friends was getting locked up. Everybody had a story to tell. Like every 10, 15 minutes, we hear about, yo, so-and-so just got locked up. Okay, so we get off the phone and get another call. Now so-and-so just got locked up, da-da-da-da. So, you know, it was a domino effect when all that had happened. And, now, you know, after everything had transpired, my man Rat told my other manager, who is also locked up right now, but wasn't at the time, said, yo, I was getting signs from everywhere. And he was like, yo, Malice even told me that it would break his heart if I was locked up. And I don't know what made me say it, And I didn't know he took that as a sign. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I found out all this later. He remembered that, like, you know, and I remember that. You know what I'm saying? And even to this day, Tony will tell you, he says to me when I go to visit him, he's like, yo, you tried to tell me, didn't you? You tried to tell me, didn't you? It was crazy. It was crazy.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that was obviously a very, very intense time for you guys, especially since it was, you know, you and your brother escaped that.
Bro, let me tell you something, man. It was the most surreal time in my life. You know, when you see this kind of thing happen and you look at all the people, you know, friends, family that you've been partying with, everybody you've been traveling the world with, everybody you've been celebrating, you know, this lifestyle with, you know, and then you finally see what happens, things that you thought you were above, when you see the wives of these guys that are going to jail, when you see these kids of the guys that, you know, that are in jail, when you see the kids having to look at daddy, you know, with some thick glass between them, when you see it, man, it ain't just like talking about it. Like, this is real. You know what I'm saying? So it internalized in me, and I get it. I get it. And for it to come back, you know, full circle after 10 years of, you know, us doing our thing, I wonder how many other people, you know, who it has affected. Now, jail, that's one thing. But, you know, you got to remember, people have died, you know, living this kind of life. So it makes you think about what you've been celebrating. If you got anything about you, anything in your heart, anything, you know, in your conscience, anything in your mind, if you got anything about you that's worth a damn, you have to think about what you're doing.
Yeah. And you grapple on the new record a little bit with what happened.
We was in the kitchen, water in the pot, playing Top Chef till Tony got shot. Wake up call. It was like time stop, but you gotta love Tony because the dime never dropped.
Listen, man, it ain't too much grappling. Life is life. You know, things happen. I hear from Tony quite regular. He's doing okay, you know, under the circumstances.
That's good to hear.
And I will tell you this, and I will tell any young kid that's listening to your podcast and old kids alike, he regrets what he did. Now, I don't, yeah, listen, if that ain't he regrets what he did, how he lived, he regrets it. He regrets it. So if that tells you anything, you know, and let me tell you something, you know, you're not going to do it as well as Tony did it. You're just not going to. You're not going to do it that well. And you're just not. I'm just telling you, you're just not going to do it that well. And, you know, he's seen the best of the best, the cream of the crop, and he regrets it. So, you know, next time you think about that kind of lifestyle, remember Tony.
Yeah. And when we were talking about your career, we actually skipped over inadvertently one of the main parts of it, which is like you guys making some of the most important mixtapes during your hiatus.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The We Got It For Cheap, especially the first two. What's the story behind the creation of those tapes? Were those verses that were supposed to be on an album? Like, how did that happen?
Absolutely not. We don't have layover verses. We have never done like 50 songs, 50 records, and then scale back 12, you know, figure out which ones are the hottest. Every song we write, we use. It ain't no leftovers, ain't nothing. We don't even like writing that much. You know what I'm saying? So we're not just, we don't just have a surplus of rhymes, you know, just sitting around. So you know, everything was fresh, and we just wrote because we were having problems with the label. Everything was at a standstill, and, you know, we just had to keep ourselves relevant. You know, people forget about you quick. So we just decided to do the We Got It For Cheap mixtape. Had a lot of fun with those mixtapes, too.
Yeah. And something that I was curious about with them, especially by the time of the first one, it seemed like Pusher was taking a bit more of a public role. He was doing the interludes. He was doing many of the hooks, things like that. Why did you kind of back off and have him take more of sort of the voice of the group role a little bit during that period?
It's totally reflective of where I was in my life, because at that point in time, I hated everybody. I said, hey, listen, I said, rap, schmap. Like, I didn't care nothing about no rapping. Like, you couldn't even talk to me about no rapping. I didn't want to hear it. Like, I'm like, what's up? We supposed to be rocking. The label's acting funny. This one over here, that one over there is all crazy, you know. And we just got caught. We just got caught in the middle of a terrible situation. So my enthusiasm, I could care less about rapping, or I didn't want to hear. Don't even talk to me about no rapping. Like, for real. That was real, you know. So that's just where I was at. I wasn't even going to be on that mixtape. The first one, I don't know if you noticed, but I think I'm only on like maybe 3 or 4 songs or whatever. Yeah. It was something short, because I ain't rapping.
And always at the end of every
song.
Yeah,
you know, always at the end. But that was just how it was. That it was really nothing behind that. That's just how it was. I come in as the cleanup man.
Right. That's something I was wondering about too, is you guys had a pretty common formula, both on the mixtape records. It seemed like your brother went first and you went last on many of them. And mm-hmm. on Clips records, it was like he would go first, and especially in the early days, you'd each do a 16 and then a break and then like a half verse each at the end. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about like how much you thought about like setup, why different arrangements work, things like that.
It's just the way it was, bro. We didn't even give too much thought to that. Things just played out pretty much the way, you know, just the way they were. It's no science behind it. Well, I think we kind of both wrote at home, and when it was time to lay it down, I just come in and lay it down and leave. Like, I was not for sticking around and hanging out, you know, at the studio. Like, I like to spend my time how I like to spend my time.
Yeah. And one other thing was, you know, about that period, the kind of like, you know, 04, 05, 06, sort of around there, that was the time when the people going to your shows and writing about your music kind of changed a little bit. Like, there were more white fans. I was certainly among them. That was around the period I discovered your music. What was on your end? What was that like to experience?
When I think of my fans, I think of white fans. That's what comes to mind. You know, in the beginning, when Grindin' first come out, you know, we was in every hood. Like, we was getting all of the dope boy money. You know what I'm saying? was paying for us to come out there. You know what I'm saying? And really, it's where it started. And we did our legwork, you know, in the hood. And it just somehow or another, you know, just our fans, you know, I would look out into the audience and it was just, you know, a whole bunch of white people. But I really believe it was like the, you know, the college kids and the hipsters. And I just think they gravitated toward the intellectualism of it all. You know, they knew what was cool. Everything in the hood starts first. Everything that's cool starts in the hood first, and then it grows, you know, underground. Then it just grows outward. You know what I'm saying? And they just wanted to just to be down, and they knew that Clips was from the ground up, and they caught on to it.
Yeah, and one of the mixtape lines I think it's actually on the Re-Up Gang album. Maybe you have that song "My Life's This Shit," where you talk about how in France the appetizer's the entree.
Appetizers, the entree, champagne capital, you still sipping Andre, Champs-Élysées, shopaholic, my arms ache.
Yeah. And that just got me thinking about, like, what was it like to go overseas for the first time?
Wait a minute, you caught that. Hey, listen, let me tell you something, bro. I don't think no one ever caught that, yo. I'm like, yo, is they catching my lyrics or what? That's what's up. Yeah, you know, for the first time we went overseas was with Jay-Z, and you know, he had us go on tour with him, and of course it was like an awesome experience to, you know, visit places like Germany and Italy and, you know, France and all of that. And it was just an eye opener to see places that you've, you know, only heard about or seen on TV or whatever, whatever. But then after a while, it started feeling like a second home because we were always overseas, even with the on the hiatus and we did the mixtapes. Like those mixtapes took us overseas as well. You know, we were doing tours off the mixtape overseas. So, you know, I got real familiar with different places and it's just awesome.
Yeah. And one other specific lyric that I caught it this time was on I think it's on the same record, on Break It Back. You have that We Don't Never Say Shit, We're the Blue Man Group.
And the law don't understand our truth. We gon' never say shit, we the Blue Man Group. We gon'
talk. Hey, Sean, I have to thank you, bro, because you get it. You get it. We the Blue Man Group.
Yeah. No doubt. What inspired that line? Like, it's just like, it's just so sort of left field, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Just talking about, you know, never snitching and, you know, lay down and die with the things that you have done, you know, right or wrong. If you decided to do it, you need to ride with whatever it is you've done. And, you know, I'm sure I probably had been in Vegas or something, seeing the Blue Man Group on every billboard and sign or whatever, and just put it together.
That's great. That's great. And so you have the memoir, the Wretched, Pitiful, Poor, Blind, and Naked.
Yeah.
And you know, the Hear Ye Him, the record.
Right.
And I know, you know, this is how we met originally, was talking about a podcast that you started. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, yes. It's Re-Envision Radio. Right now we're on SoundCloud, soundcloud.com/Re-Envision. And, you know, it's me and the Iceman. Iceman, he did the interludes on my album, Hear Ye Him, that you can also get off of Amazon and Google Play and online, stuff like that. But me and the Iceman, we sit, we talk about life, we talk about God, we talk about God in our life, you know, just open people up to some fundamental truths, man. It's not about force feeding anything, but I think a lot of things that people don't know is because they have not been introduced. Like, and I have to keep it all the way real with you. Like, I'm not one for hocus pocus. Like, I am a realist. You know what I'm saying? You can't tell me about Santa Claus and expect me to believe it. Like, I'm just not that. But I will tell you this. When I read that Bible, it is so many things that apply to my life that I actually walk certain scenarios in my life that happened thousands of years ago and is still relevant to me this day. And would have even helped me to make better decisions, you know, in my life. So that's how I know, you know, the truth and the reality of Jesus Christ.
What other projects are you working on right now? What else is going on?
I speak to at-risk youth at, you know, whenever they call me. I speak at a lot of different colleges and universities. I just shot a I Am Second film. Now, I Am Second, it's an organization that they take, you know, everybody, man, whether you're a celebrity, whether you're, you know, just the average Joe, and they talk and they tell their testimony. One of their bigger films are one of Lecrae, the drummer from Korn. They just did the people from Duck Dynasty as well. And yeah, so I was fortunate enough. They really found an interest in my story. And we shot an I Am Second film. So y'all be looking for that as well. It has my brother in it. It has Pharrell in it. It's really a big deal. And, you know, like we said, the podcast. I also have the audiobook that's out there as well. I haven't been talking about that too much. But the audiobook is a really good listening, man. It's not just me narrating my book, but you get sound effects. You know, we call it an audio movie. And I'm also currently working on new music.
Oh, very exciting. So follow-up record maybe to Hear Ye Him.
Yeah, to Hear Ye Him, definitely. I still got more to say, man.
That's really, really excited. I can't wait to hear it all. Is there anything else you'd want to tell our audience?
You know, just stay tuned and keep looking out for No Malice. Oh, and y'all can hit me up at NoMalice757 on Twitter, and also NoMalice757 on Instagram. Check me out.
All right. Well, and I know that every time you talk to someone, they ask about, you know, the possibility of, you know, reuniting and all that kind of stuff. I don't particularly want to get into, like, is it going to happen? Is it going to not happen? But I was more curious about, like, do you see yourself able at some point, you know, whether it's now or a year or 5 years, able to perform some of those old songs again?
No, I don't. I don't. I do have a lot of songs that I wouldn't mind performing, but I feel like the time is just very crucial right now, and I don't want to send any mixed messages to anyone. My story is real. My testimony is very real, and if it wasn't real, then I would be in the clips right now. You understand what I'm saying? If all this was a joke, you know, I'd be doing clips music and touring and everywhere right now. And the thing is, when you see something that you know you have personally seen, when you know you've seen something, you know, you can't deny it. Now, if someone told you about it, you might can deny it. But when you've seen something with your own two eyes, you know what I'm saying? Like, I can't unsee what I saw. So with that being said, I do believe in the future that Clips could really, like, do another album together, you know, a few albums together. But it would have to be some reconstructing.
Mm-hmm. That definitely makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you. Thanks so much for all your time, man. I really, really appreciate it. And yeah, thanks so much for hanging out and talking to us.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys. Thank you very much.
The thing I was most struck by was how genuine he was in the stuff he was saying about religion. When I went back to listen to his catalog, I was struck that the conflict between God and Mammon had been there literally from day one, and runs throughout his catalog. His religious belief was there from the beginning, and so this new stage as No Malice only makes sense. I was glad he got to tell his story about that. My favorite part of the interview, though, was when we talked about Wamp Wamp and he apologized for the Deep Lake the Hutu line. I wasn't expecting that at all. There are a couple controversial lyrics on that song. There's that one, and then there's the, you know, cooks to a tightwad, the Pyrex is Jewish line. You should listen to the song for the full context. So I wasn't even sure which one of those lyrics he was going to focus on, but it seemed like he's been wanting to talk about that Hutu line for a long time, and I'm really proud that this show is the place where he got to do it. The stuff about his time in the army is crazy. How many people are going to tell Pharrell, just hold on 2.5 years, I gotta go do something, you know? That was pretty wild to uncover. And I think the bit at the end makes it pretty clear that anyone who wants to see a Clips reunion, they're going to have to wait for a new record, because there's no way those old songs are happening. In his art and in his conversation, he's 100% honest and from the heart, and I'm really glad that I got to share that with you. Join us next week when our guest will be photographer, cinematographer, director, sneakerhead, hip-hop historian, Lisa Leone. Lisa talked to us in support of her new book of photos and exhibition at the Bronx Museum called Here I Am, Photographs of Lisa Leone. There are amazing photos in there of so many iconic hip-hop figures. Snoop Dogg, the Fugees, Fab Five Freddy, Biggie. There are incredible and intimate photos of all kinds of people at the most fascinating points in their whole career. To make sure you never miss an episode of The Cypher, find us on iTunes From there, you can subscribe and leave a review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Hit me up. Let me know your thoughts for future guests, what you thought of this show, anything you'd want to talk about. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Tell me about Santa Claus and expect me to believe it.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Who is also locked up right now, but wasn't at the time.
The architect of the newly redesigned TheCypherShow.com is Paul Dice.
It would break his heart if I was locked up.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
This is God right here.
Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Josh wanted to badmouth the phone situation, but we got it popping.